From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. It's getting hot up here. At the same time that Connecticut pulls out of what was once touted as a critical regional climate initiative.
But with any of these market-based programs, the larger the market, the more powerful the incentive is, and the easier it is for implementation of it.
How to stay safe today and the impact on climate tomorrow. Did you think your employer was going to embrace a hybrid work life after the pandemic?
Employers were concerned about workers becoming less productive when they were not being surveilled. Then with the onset of COVID, we had no choice but to work at home, those of us who could work at home.
And have they? Anxiety as offices reopen. Plus, we'll bring you the latest on public safety from acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is hotter in Greater Boston today than it is in Florida. Day three of the first heat wave of 2021. And a reminder that a heat wave here is three or more days at or above 90 degrees. So let's check the calendar. Yep, nope, it is the beginning of June and we are here already. So it's time to brush off our strategies for staying safe and cool in this kind of humid heat, but also to find out whether this is the shape of an ice cream melting scorcher to come this summer. Joining us is WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. David, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So does it raise any flags to you to see a heat wave this early in the year?
The short answer is no. You know, we tend to like to make conclusions about what we're observing now to what it's going to do in the future. And in this case, this is really just, you know, a weather phenomena where we're having a heat wave early in June. It's happened before. We've had other June heat waves. You don't have to go back that far to find them. We've had worse heat waves. You go back to 1925, actually. It was a brutal summer. It hit 100 degrees during the same week. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a hot summer. It's actually possible. I'm not predicting this, but it's possible this could be end up being the hottest week of the whole summer.
Interesting. All right. So when will it break then? That's fascinating. When will it break? How long is this going to sort of drag on for us this one?
Right. So today, obviously, we're in the thick of it. We had some drier air kind of mixed down from the upper levels of the atmosphere this afternoon. So it actually became a little more comfortable in terms of humidity. I think that humidity goes up tonight. It's going to be one of those really warm and muggy nights, staying above 70 for most places all night long. Cape and the Islands will probably get into the 60s. Tomorrow, very humid, even more humid than today. I don't think we'll mix down the dry air tomorrow. So it's one of those days that's even more uncomfortable. Temperatures probably 2 degrees or so less hot than today. So we hit 95 in Boston as of us speaking. It could still go up another degree, but it's unlikely. So tomorrow, probably 92 to 93. But with the humidity, it will probably feel worse. Wednesday, also very humid across the area. I think we stay just under 90 on Wednesday, so 88, 87 degrees, but still super humid. And then finally, as we head for late Wednesday night, but more during the day on Thursday, we'll get some drier air in here and it'll start to cool off. So that's really the day that we'll really feel better.
Okay, so last question for you. This is serious. This kind of heat can be dangerous, especially with that humidity. How do we beat it? What precautions should people take to stay cool?
Yeah, it's sort of all the common sense stuff that we all should be doing. Number one, don't spend too much time outside. If you need to be outside working especially, stay hydrated. Water's the most critical thing you can do is stay hydrated. If you want to avoid heat exhaustion, which is serious, heat stroke, which is downright dangerous and deadly, those two things can happen, especially if you get dehydrated in this heat. Try to find somewhere cool. You know, go inside to an air-conditioned building. If you don't have an air-conditioned building, start your car, put the air conditioner on, cool yourself off for a little bit, and obviously, never leave kids or pets in the car in any type of this weather. The car can go to 120, 130 degrees in literally a matter of 10 minutes. So it would kill an animal if it were in there.
All right. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. Dave, thanks.
You're welcome.
And listeners, a reminder once again to check on your neighbors, loved ones, especially the elderly, to make sure that they are staying cool and they are safe in this heat. So let's transition now to a piece of climate news in the region that we want to pay attention to. On Friday, Connecticut backed out of the Regional Transportation Climate Initiative. That initiative formally launched in December, and it was designed to create a regional strategy for paying for emissions and investing in green technology. But it got off on tough footing. Only Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C. were on board at the launch after a dozen states had originally been engaged in the planning. And with Connecticut out, that raises questions about its viability. This is an initiative that relies on regional cooperation for success. Joining Radio Boston to break it down for us is David Cash, former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, current dean and associate professor of the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Dean Cash, welcome.
Thank you so much, Christiana. It's great to be back on Radio Boston.
So I understand you were on the ground floor of developing this initiative. We are down from 13 initial jurisdictions who were interested to 3. Why? Mm-hmm. What is the issue causing these pullouts?
Well, let me just start with two points, and I hate to kind of be correcting, but I do want to note on Dave Epstein's report that, yes, we might have had these kinds of heat waves in the past in early June, but all of the science is showing that we're going to see repeated higher probability of these events earlier and lasting longer as we move out further in a climate change world, which is exactly why this transportation initiative is so important. And just another quick note, Connecticut didn't quite back out. The legislature, as every state will have to deal with this themselves, the governor is still on board. The legislature is not ready right now. It might take it up in the next session. And that's how these regional cooperative ventures happen. And it happened with the regional greenhouse gas initiative as well. But
so let's pick up on that.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Pick up on that. First, just to confirm what you were just saying, City of mm-hmm. Boston's Climate Ready Initiative predicts mm-hmm. that while Boston averages around 11 days per year of 90 degree temperatures, that could reach 40 days per year mm-hmm. by 2030, for example. And exactly. To the point that the legislature in Connecticut didn't sign on, right? Mm-hmm. So is that not a problem? If you've got a lack of political will on an ambitious regional initiative, doesn't that mm-hmm. defang the initiative?
So sure, it's not great news that the legislature in Connecticut decided that they didn't want to take this step right now. But at this moment, Connecticut and all of the states that have been involved have committed to reducing their emissions, and in the transportation sector, which is a much more, it's a growing sector right now. And so this kind of market-based initiative that provides incentives for the growth of electric vehicles, for buying electric vehicles, for reducing consumers' costs, I'm not going to say at the pump, but at the outlet. This has win-win-win all over it. And so I think it's a matter of time that states like Connecticut and others come on board, as they did for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where the initial states all showed that this kind of policy puts money in the pocket of consumers, provides incentives for there to be technological development, competes with China in electric vehicles. I mean, it's win-win-win. And this one has a piece of it where states that earn the revenues from these auctions that are done on the fossil fuel companies will be giving those or investing those in the communities, exactly those most hard hit by the pollution that's been caused by transportation.
So I'm going to pull it back from you for a second. So what we are talking about is essentially auctions for emissions. Some mm-hmm. of that cost can be passed on to consumers, for example, through gas prices, although those price increases are capped. And then that money can be used for other investments, just so our listeners know what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what changes, David, that later legislators and legislatures that are not on board with things like the gas price increases, mm-hmm. which ostensibly is part of why Connecticut wasn't on board, are going to get on board with this?
So there are a couple of things. One is, if the states, the small number of states do go ahead with it and show the benefits, the hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars regional-wide that get pumped back into the economies, exactly what happened with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, consumers benefited. That's one. The other is, there's an administration now in Washington that is really leaning forward on transportation, on electric vehicles. So you can imagine, in a future in which there are incentives for consumers, where there's funding that's going to public transportation, where that would provide incredible tailwind for states to be part then of this regional compact that will just be additive or even multiplicative to what's going on in Washington.
So then the last question that is on my mind about this, I hear you, is this is regional. There's interdependence in a regional social problem and in regional solutions. Mm-hmm. Do we have a chicken and an egg problem here, that you need more states to show the benefits so more states will go on? Or do you think the limited number currently participating really can get those kinds of outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, that is actually a really good question, and there should be some good analysis. And I'm sure the states now that are leading, and again, all the other states are still looking at this carefully. Nobody has said we're definitively not doing it. Remember, this is, let's talk chicken and egg. We're talking executive agencies and legislators that are working back and forth. So there certainly can be a time in which, after the right kind of analysis, after they see what's happening in Washington, where legislators really understand that this is a big win for their constituents, a big win for communities, a big win for people who want to save at the outlet, who want to pay lower maintenance costs, who want better access to public transportation. These are all things in poll after poll after poll people want. And that's what this kind of policy will give them, and do it at the least possible cost. And in fact, a cost to the fossil fuel companies, who are the ones who should be paying for this pollution, but not for the consumers.
All right. We will continue to follow it. Sorry, we're short on time today. David Cash, former Wonderful. Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection and a current dean of the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk about remote work. We have been in full reopen mode here in the Commonwealth for more than a week now, and employers whose workers went home for the pandemic are figuring out how and how much to come back to work in person. Now, this after a lot of companies signaled that remote work was working for productivity and for employees, which puts us at this tense moment. Will employers choose a new, more hybrid path, or will the pull to return to normal pull everyone back into the office full time? We want to know from you, if you have been working remotely, what's your employer doing? Do you know? Have they told you? Maybe you're back or you're preparing to go back. And if you are you excited about it or dreading it? And did you get to give input? Also, what parts of remote work at this point are you hoping to keep long-term, and what would you like to jettison for the old way? 800-423-8255, or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Joining us for this conversation is Ellen Ruppelschell, author of The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change, and Kim Merriman, professor of management at the Manning School of Business at UMass Lowell. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation. Glad to be here.
So, Kim, I'm going to start with you. You and two of your colleagues, David Greenway and Tamara Montag-Smith, recently wrote an article for The Conversation detailing, quote, how employees are feeling burned over broken work-from-home promises and corporate culture BS as employers try to bring them back to the office, end quote. So tell us more. Why are people feeling burned?
Thanks, Tiziana. And the title, by the way, wasn't just being creative. We took what the quotes were from what we were hearing. And the real theme of what we were hearing, but let me back up a moment. We first studied this July 2020 last year, when people were required to work remotely, most office workers anyway. So let me preface that up front, that I'm really, for this particular research I'm sharing with you right now, talking about office type workers that can work remotely. I know many of us could not. And
many frontline workers have been working in the company or the business all along.
Exactly. So I want to acknowledge that. My husband's one of them. He's a healthcare worker. So I know what that's like. But there was this large segment that could work remotely. And we looked at them in July to see, because there was a parallel trend. People were moving geographically, their homes, not their jobs, but they had this locational freedom all of a sudden. And we wanted to see what was going on, look at their motives. Long story short on that July data is it was clear that a segment of them were moving far enough away and permanently enough that they were not intending to go back in person to their current employer. Another chunk moved within commuting distance, but far enough away that they were hoping for at least a hybrid model. So these workers, many of them weren't intending to leave their employer. They just anticipated having continued freedom. So we, in March, looked at additional data because we said, okay, well, how is this starting to shape up? And that's where we saw the broken promises start to emerge. Number of companies still hadn't communicated their message on remote work policy. You know, we were all, including leaders, companies, workers, still trying to figure it out. But the companies that did start to communicate it were not framing it well. And the ones that were not willing to still allow flexibility were starting to lose employees. So what we predicted could happen did start to happen. And fast forward another couple months past that, and we're seeing much more of it.
So I'd love to, I want to bring in Ellen here. And Ellen, both you can react to what Kim just told us from the research from work last summer and then again in March. And then also, you know, what is new and not new about this idea of remote work? And let me just invite listeners here to 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to tell us if you've experienced a broken promise or if you're planning on going back soon. Ellen, let me turn to you.
Yes. Well, of course, what Kimberly said is was not all that surprising to me, because dating back to certainly the 1980s, when telework became a thing, it was predicted that the office would become retro. It would no longer play such a large role in the American workforce. And in fact, that is not what happened. People did not flee the office. I mean, certainly some people were able to work remotely at some time, but by and large, people were expected to show up. And the reason for that, most would agree, is that the employers feel more comfortable surveilling their employees. They like to see them. And in fact, there's been a lot of research done that employees do everything possible to appear to be at work, even when they're not. For example, leaving their jackets on their chairs when they go for the evening, right? They're supposed to be hard at work all the time. So there's always been some resistance to this idea of people working remotely. Now, what's transpired in this natural experiment, which is what COVID really produced, a kind of natural experiment where so many people had no choice but to work at home, what employers have discovered is that productivity, if anything, increased for most employees. So the idea that you're more productive in the office has really been challenged by this experiment. So why people are, you know, being required to come in remains, you know, a really unsolved question, right? Depending on who you're working and where you're working.
So let's stay with that, because I want to engage with the both of you on that. Let me just ask listeners one more time. Your organization, does it trust you? Do you feel like you've been more productive since you've been home? Do you think you'll stay as productive when you go back to the office if you're going back? 1-800-423-8255. Kim and Ellen, I do want to interrogate this a little bit, because if productivity, in fact, hasn't fallen, and in fact, it sounds like the research is saying it's at least as high, if not more high, and if workers are saying, I feel betrayed by my company for bringing me back full time, maybe with poor communication or maybe too soon or maybe too much, then why would employers continue to forge ahead? Isn't it time for employers to change? I don't know. I guess that sounds like I'm making a statement. I'm not. Does it behoove employers to change their perception about what productivity is and how you get there? Kim, maybe you can start on that.
Sure, I'd love to. I think yes. I think a couple things are going on here, that people in general are resistant to change, whether it's good change or bad change. And so we see some leaders, some managers probably feeling that resistance. There's sunk cost involved when you have a hierarchy in an organization, when your job role is defined by the number of people under you. So those sunk costs need to be addressed. But also, even leaders that want to embrace this, they say, well, I need to figure out how. So we need some training. We need to be really gentle with each other as we go forward and figure it out together. So Tim Cook of Apple is finding that out firsthand. Leaders, and in my sample with my colleagues, with my research team, we found this. Leaders send out the memo and they think a memo alone is going to be enough. Employees want to have a voice. So start the conversation. If I had one bit of advice to give to a leader, I would say, open up the conversation put away the memo.
And just very briefly, Kim, what was the mistake Tim Cook at Apple made for our listeners who may not know?
Okay, sorry. A couple of days ago, he sent the memo that Apple employees who have been working remotely would need to be back 3 days a week starting in September. And not just any 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So the response from employees, which, by the way, they were able to collaborate virtually to come up with this response. So there is community built virtually, it would appear. The response was, wait a minute, some people quit, but they're pushing back and saying, we want options. It's not that they all want to work remotely. They want choice and they want their voice heard. So that's what's going on at Apple right now.
So what are the management challenges, Ellen, to that? What do we need to be aware of? Let's say an employer wants to take that object lesson that Kim just laid out. What are the management challenges, or maybe the plant and equipment, the paying for an office all the time when not everybody's in it? What are those challenges? What do they need to think about?
Well, I think Kimberly really hit it on the head when she said change is hard. This change has been so long in coming. It's more than generational. As I said, it dates back to the 1980s when there's been this resistance to having people out of sight who work for you, but are out of sight. It makes people, the loss of control can drive management nuts, right? So I also agree that there needs to be training and rethinking and incentivizing of this. I think millennials more than boomers are pretty excited about this. They've grown up with the idea, both men and women, that they're going to have this so-called work-life balance, that they're not going to devote every waking minute to their employer, if possible. So I think the younger staff members will be quite open to this. But again, adjustments need to be made. Not everyone has a quiet place to work at home, for example. Maybe they need to be reimbursed to some degree for their home office. The environmental benefits of not commuting every day are enormous. And maybe there should be tax incentives provided to employers to encourage this. Again, I believe in, I think as Kimberly does, I believe in carrots rather than sticks. But there are so many carrots to be had when we have a flexible workplace.
So let's talk a little bit about what that future could look like. And I want to play a little bit of a conversation with Raj Chaudhry, an associate professor who studies remote work at Harvard Business School. Our producer, Paris Alston, spoke with him, and he says the office still will have a place of importance, but not so much for work.
We'll go to the office to meet other colleagues for social interactions. So we don't have to be in office every day. Some teams could say we'll go 1 week a month. And some other teams could say we'll go a couple of months in February, and then we'll go back in July or August, and then we'll go back in November. And those like 6 weeks we are together, we're going to have dinners together, we'll make memories together.
So Kim, that is a huge vision shift. And as Ellen was talking, a generational shift. Is what we just heard the might be, or is it the inevitable will be?
Some companies are in fact doing that. Some are still figuring it out. So the CEO of Salesforce, I love his off the cuff suggestion. They might buy a ranch, and that's where employees will gather. The key would be in agreement with what we just heard, that make it a place employees want to go rather than imposing it as a place that you must go to. And then they figure out when they need to be there. That seems to be a model that the people we are seeing in our data are rallying around. Again, it's about choice. I've had some people contact me that their colleagues were like family. But many, though, are really embracing the idea of needing, wanting flexibility. Working parents who used to have difficulty trying to combine community stability with career mobility, for example, they're going to benefit from this. So part of our research gets into the notion of community residence. I won't talk about that more now unless you have a question, but I would love to see people engaging with the community too, not just the colleagues being siloed and it would benefit organizations. That's the kind of network organizations need today.
So, Ellen, as I listen and I think about this, I'm also mindful that we're continuing to hear stories of employers having trouble filling jobs. And this whole vision is one where it feels like the power and the cards are in the hands of the employees. In a different economy, and I understand we're in an unprecedented economy coming out of a 100-year pandemic, but in a different economy, is this a different conversation? Is this partly on the table because employees have a lot of power now, or am I just looking in the wrong direction?
Oh, you're certainly not looking in the wrong direction. I mean, this is very, very important. You know, what Marx called our army of labor, which was a problem, because when there are too many people to fill the number of positions that are available, workers lose power. So now there's at least a perception that workers are desired as opposed to the other way around, right? So this is the time potentially where this leverage can have an impact, but we have to be very careful because the notion of not enough people to fill jobs always comes under question. You know, there are reasons why employers say that. They'll often say that there are not enough trained workers, that there's a skills gap. But in fact, workers who are seriously looking for employees are willing to train them and are willing to pay them adequately. There's a large part of the workforce, both men and women, who are a little leery about coming back right now for good reason. They have childcare issues. They have other issues. Some people, we have to keep in mind, have long COVID, so they're disabled to some degree at this point, quite a few actually. So they've dropped out of the workforce, but potentially temporarily. So this is a temporary situation. And I hope that employees can build on it. I'm hopeful. I don't think it's quite certain yet whether they can.
All right. So that is Ellen Ruppelschell, author of The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change, and Kim Merriman, professor of management at the Manning School of Business at UMass Lowell. Ellen and Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Earlier today, I informed Dennis White of his termination as commissioner of the Boston Police Department, effective immediately.
That is acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey, announcing just this hour that Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White is out of his job following decades-old allegations of domestic violence. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker is on the story and joins us now. Deb, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I know this basically just came down, Deb, and we've been looking for this, waiting for this announcement for a while. Tell us, what's the decision?
Well, as you said, Acting Mayor Janey says Dennis White is terminated effective immediately. He's also off the police force entirely. Not even, some had wondered if he might go back to being a detective lieutenant, but that will not be the case here. Acting Mayor Janey says Interim Commissioner Greg Long will stay in that role for the time being. And she says she's forming a committee and laying the groundwork to conduct a national search for a new commissioner, and she says that search will include extensive vetting and background checks of any candidates going forward.
So, again, we've been at this a while. I know that it was mid-May when Acting Mayor Janey originally planned to fire Dennis White, but take us through the why, and did she address that again today?
She did. Acting Mayor Janey planned to fire Dennis White once she received an independent investigation that was done about decades-old domestic abuse allegations concerning White's ex-wife, who's also a Boston police officer. Now, that investigation uncovered the allegations of domestic abuse and another allegation of abuse involving White's niece by marriage. The investigation also described a culture of fear within the police department and indicated that officers were concerned about speaking to the investigator. So today, Janey said that White's reluctance to completely cooperate with the investigator and his conduct around all of this led her to conclude that he did not possess the qualities to lead the Boston Police Department going forward. Now, she had said some of that initially. White had challenged that in court, arguing that there was no due process, and the court courts shot that down, essentially. Janey held a closed-door hearing last week on his termination. She said she would consider what happened in that hearing going forward and make a decision. And today she said she basically decided. Here's a bit of Acting Mayor Janey speaking a few moments ago.
It is clear that Dennis White's return as commissioner would send a chilling message to victims of domestic violence in our city and reinforce a culture of fear and a blue wall of silence in our police department.
Now, Acting Mayor Janey also said that White did not express regret for what happened with his ex-wife and instead vilified her. So she felt that this was the decision that she needed to make to basically, what she said, start a new chapter in Boston. She called it a new day for the city and for the city's police department.
So, Deb, to that point, in a minute, I'd like to hear what the response from White's team is, but let's talk a little bit about that vilification. Last week, it became just a more painful story as White's ex-wife herself started to speak out about the abuse. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Right. She started to speak out and she said, you know, White had provided testimony from his eldest daughter and from another family member saying that his ex-wife was the aggressor in the relationship. And then she spoke out and said that that it was a very toxic relationship and he was very abusive and aggressive. And then White's attorney asked for the internal affairs records of his ex-wife, because as we said, she's a Boston police officer. So it got to be very, very messy and a lot of back and forth going on.
All right. So the announcement again, just a little bit ago, but any response from Dennis White or his attorney?
That's right. Dennis White's attorney released a statement saying that saying, quote, Commissioner White is deeply disappointed by Acting Mayor Janey's decision. Quote, he is a black man falsely accused of crimes, not given a fair trial or hearing, and then convicted or terminated, which is the equivalent here. This reflects an ugly pattern in our country. That's a statement from Dennis White's attorney, Nick Carter. Now, this is an argument that Attorney Carter made earlier in this case, and Acting Mayor Janey touched upon that during her press conference this afternoon. She said that the treatment of black people in this country is a genuine concern, but she said racism is a burden carried by both men and women of color, and she said she will not turn a blind eye to domestic violence against black women or any women.
So as we've been following this story, Deb, we've talked, for example, to retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, who suggested that part of the White team legal strategy might have been anticipating a termination and pursuing other legal means and maybe payment. What are White's legal options at this point?
Well, he could file a lawsuit, and he has questioned in the past whether there is legal cause to remove him from the job, because he was interim commissioner for just days before he was removed when the Boston Globe uncovered the domestic violence allegations. And today, White's attorney said that White intends to amend his complaint to assert civil rights claims to try to recover any losses and to, quote, send a message that this kind of unlawful treatment must not be allowed to happen again to anyone, end quote. So it does appear that there will be further legal action going forward.
So in our couple remaining minutes, let's turn our attention to former Mayor Marty Walsh. This scandal heavily implicates him. He's now in a new job in Washington. He's now Labor Secretary. He went on WBZ-TV this weekend to reiterate that he had no knowledge of the allegations against White.
I had no knowledge of Dennis White's past in the police department. I had no understanding of it. If I had, obviously decisions would have been different, and the acting mayor wouldn't be going through the situation now, and Boston wouldn't be. It's disappointing, and I wish I had known.
So what's at stake for Marty Walsh?
Well, that has been Marty Walsh's consistent explanation, that he did not know about these allegations. And I guess Walsh's continued involvement in all of this will depend on any future legal action and how that might play out. And if there is a lawsuit, Walsh might have to explain under oath what he knew and when. And we should say that White and former police commissioner William Gross allege that Walsh knew about these allegations against White when he was first promoted to the command staff in 2014. So White could argue that Janey has no grounds to fire him because his past had already been disclosed. That would be the essential argument. And former police commissioner Evans did back up Walsh and said that he was not aware of these allegations against Dennis White. So, depending on what happens further legally, there could be, this story could stay in the public eye, and there could be testimony certainly involving former Mayor Walsh.
All right, WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker, thanks for that quick turnaround. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Come back and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.